Coming up on Path to Zero.
The hybrid is by far and away the best way that we can decarbonize as quickly as possible. Battery electric vehicles, but there aren't enough of them, and they're not going to be enough of them rapidly.
Welcome to Path to Zero, the podcast about clean energy and the journey toward a low-carbon future. Your host is Tucker Perkins, engineer, entrepreneur, business leader, speaker, and clean energy industry veteran, who now serves as president and CEO of the Propane Education and Research Council. Now, here's Tucker.
Welcome, everyone. It's great to have you along for another episode of Path to Zero. This is part one of a two-part episode where we're talking internal combustion engines with two brilliant thinkers. Here's the setup. Most vehicles on the planet use the internal combustion engine, so improving its technology, from the engine design all the way to the fuels, can have a huge immediate impact on reducing emissions globally. Does that mean we ought to switch everything over to battery electric vehicles? I know my opinion on that subject, but I want you to hear answers to that question from two experts on engine technology, one in the UK and the other here in the United States. Dr. Felix Leach and Dr. Kelly Senecal are two authors of a new book called Racing Toward Zero, The Untold Story of Driving Green. Dr. Leach is an associate professor of engineering science at the University of Oxford, where his research is focused on emissions, engine efficiency, and air quality. Dr. Senecal is a co-founder and owner of Convergent Science, a computational fluid dynamics software company headquartered in Madison, Wisconsin. He's also an adjunct professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and an associate editor of the journal Transportation Engineering. Kelly and Felix, welcome, and thanks for joining us on Path to Zero.
Thanks for having us, Tucker.
Yeah, thanks, Tucker. It's great to be here.
We're going to talk a lot about your book today, but let's start by making the casual observation that it's a fair difference between Madison, Wisconsin and Oxford, England. Temperature, culture, 3,900 nautical miles, probably. So how did the two of you get connected and what really sparked you to work together?
Yeah, maybe I'll start with that. And then Felix, you can add your bits. 2017 was the year I like to call combustion died. Of course, I'm saying that tongue in cheek. I'm saying that sarcastically, but that's really when, you know, a lot of press came out about the combustion engine being dead. And I really started to kind of pick up some advocacy in that area, saying, hey, wait a minute, don't forget about the internal combustion engine, kind of in late 2016, 2017. And around that time, Felix had written, along with some other UK academics, a letter, a response to an article from The Economist called The Death of the Internal Combustion Engine. And he was making a lot of the same points that I was making as well. And so I was like, who is this guy? You know, I tracked him down at a conference we both attended in Italy, in Capri, Italy, the beautiful island of Capri. So that was a fun time. And we kind of just hit it off from there and have kind of been working together ever since. So I don't know, Felix, if you want to add something to the story there.
No, just I think the only thing I would add is that I think Kelly and I had independently, unawares, been doing the same stuff, you know, particularly in the aftermath of Dieselgate. There was a lot of loss of trust in the auto industry generally. And this was manifesting itself as kind of, yeah, the death of the internal combustion engine. And I thought that this would be really damaging. I still do think that. And so I kind of ring-led a letter back to The Economist after this article they wrote, saying, you know, actually, we don't think you're right. And here's why. And to their credit, they published it. And that's the sort of genesis of our meeting. And Kelly and I haven't looked back really yet, you know, one book and several academic papers later.
Felix, what is the general area of interest for you in Oxford? What's your area of research?
Yeah, so my background is very much in emissions from internal combustion engines, particularly with different fuels. So my PhD was on the effect of fuel composition on particulates, so soot emissions. But then I've expanded more broadly than that. So today, you know, kind of 10, 15 years on from that, I investigate new fuels and fuels, both ones that contain carbon and ones that don't contain carbon. So fuels such as ammonia and hydrogen as well, but also looking at kind of hybrid powertrains and particularly what kind of combustion engines might be best for ultra high efficiency kind of hybrid powertrains. So I've got quite a diverse set of interests these days, but all around kind of propulsion and energy.
And Felix, I really was glad to have you as a guest today, just because I study intently the European position, which I would call slightly different than the American position, in broader terms of how we're going to address climate. But Europe is moving from a position where they were almost completely focused on diesel. And then literally overnight said diesel is bad and almost went straight to battery electric, even though now it is quite obvious that your electric grid is probably even more starved for electrons than the US grid. So what is it like? What is a fleet manager doing in Europe today when for years the whole focus was on diesel, even in light passenger cars? And now the focus is completely anti-diesel. How does a fleet manager react to that?
Tucker, it's such a good question. I mean, I think a fleet manager follows the incentives that they're given. And the thing about fleets is that they tend to get renewed fairly quickly, say in 2 or 3 years, typically a fleet would rotate. The problem is, of course, what the consequences of that. Most fleets aren't driven into the ground, they're sold on the secondhand market. And you end up with a market of vehicles that's very kind of eclectic. And I think what people have been saying is that this kind of one size fits all strategy hasn't worked for Europe in the past. You know, diesels were good in some respects, but bad in others. And everyone was saying, well, just be careful with what you're doing here. And they went, like you say, straight down the diesel pathway. And what we're saying, and I think more and more people are beginning to sort of cotton onto, is battery electric vehicles is the same story. They're brilliant in many ways, but they're not the solution to everything. And so by pursuing this kind of like one size fits all strategy again and again in Europe, we keep making mistakes and history keeps repeating itself roughly once a decade.
And I'm going to ask you one more question, then I'll get over to Kelly. But, you know, I really love your field of research because I too am deeply involved, at least in particulate matter and NOx. And I'm often struck by how everywhere, not only in the US, but in Europe, we seem to have almost a singular obsession around climate and GHG and CO2. And temperature rise, when in fact, to me, the near term and more silent killer, if you will, could easily be bronchitis, asthma, COPD, that's created by poor lung health, poor plant health, that comes to us directly as a result of particulate matter and NOx. As a person who studies that, how do you find a balance between focus on climate and focus on health?
Oh, what a million-dollar question. I think, you know, one of the sections I wrote in the book is called pollution is not a helpful word. And I think we often mislead people when we start talking about pollution from vehicles, because it's exactly as you say. Do you mean kind of CO2 or greenhouse gas emissions? Is that pollution? Or are you talking about NOx and particulate matter and all these other emissions that come out of vehicles? And, you know, we want to reduce them all, of course we do, but it's a balance, like you say, between perhaps something that's going to kill you or me, you know, with bronchitis or whatever, or something that might kill our grandchildren, great-grandchildren, great-great-grandchildren, and so on in the future. And in a sense, that's the definition of sustainability in a nutshell, is having to balance the needs of today against the needs of the future. So how do I see it? Well, you want to try and reduce them all, but I think one thing that's often missing from the discussion is the fact that, And this is a controversial point that I wrote in the book, and Kelly said to me, are you sure you want to say that? But I sort of held my ground, is that I think we have the technical solutions today to deal with the non-CO2 emissions from vehicles, you know, particulate filters for the soot, selective catalytic reduction or three-way catalysts for the other emissions. You know, they're really good. The technology today is brilliant. And I think we sometimes lose sight of that by considering in our minds, you know, vehicles from the 50s, 60s that had clouds of black smoke coming out of them that you could smell before you saw them on the freeway, you know, all that sort of thing. And I think today that's not the reality. And we see that in modern vehicles. So I think it's not necessarily an either or. We just need to make sure that we keep both of those in mind, exactly as your question suggested.
Yeah, thank you. So Kelly, let's turn to you for a moment. I think you would be considered by any measure a world-class expert in computational fluid dynamics. To the uninitiated, we often shorten that to CFD, kind of the modern term in engineering. And right. I know you've really been around one of the great mechanical engineering universities in the world, University of Wisconsin at Madison. But talk to us about your work at Convergent Science and really how you got to this point to write the book and be so invested in improving the internal combustion engine.
Yeah, that's a big question. So yeah, computational fluid dynamics, as you said, or CFD, right? So just for the people listening who may not be so familiar with that, essentially we're modeling things like engines or things like flow over airplanes, you know, aerodynamics on the computer. So instead of doing the experiments, we simulate the device on the computer, and hopefully we can improve it, make design decisions in a cheaper way, right? Before we cut metal and before we actually design it. So I kind of grew up in the engine CFD world. That's what I did in my graduate studies at the Engine Research Center here at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And that's where I really learned CFD. And I kind of came into that not really caring at all about engines, to be honest. I wanted to do CFD on a really hard problem. And engines, is a very complicated problem, right? Multi-phase flow, chemical reactions, everything that kind of makes CFD hard, you kind of have it in the engine. So it was a really good place to kind of learn about CFD. And as I continued to do it, I sort of fell in love with the internal combustion engine as a technology, right? And so, my company started many years ago to try to improve how we do CFD on internal combustion engines. And now most of the world uses our software for that application. But we've also expanded into many other applications, including e-mobility. So including battery cooling, electric motor cooling, thermal runaway problems, and things like that. But really what happened was, again, back in the 2016, 2017 timeframe, when we started to get this really big pushback on the internal combustion engine post-Dieselgate, it's like, wait a minute. You know, we need to kind of stand up to this because this isn't right. Being on the inside and really knowing how engines work and a lot of the technology that Felix alluded to about controlling the criteria pollutants and all of this, they're not nearly as bad as we're making them out to be. Yes, they need to be improved, but they're not nearly as bad. So that's sort of what pushed me down this sort of advocacy route into the book. After discussions with Felix, we decided to write this book. It just felt like there was a real need to put this out there.
Brilliant. Thank you. So let me ask both of you. I know you both really got fired up by an article in The Economist that fired me up at the time, the death of the internal combustion engine. And really, that's kind of been a narrative, as you kind of begin to say, since about 2017, with complete disregard for how dirty an electric engine could possibly be to make the power to dispose of. But do you in fact believe that the internal combustion engine is dead?
I guess I'll start. No. Okay. Well, there's should it be dead? No, for sure. It should not be dead. Okay. I think, and maybe we'll talk more about this in the conversation, but there's a long runway with the internal combustion engine, just purely from a fuel standpoint, if nothing else, right? So we like to say it's not the engine that's the problem, it's the fuel. And so there's a long runway there for the engine. There are a lot of applications where even if we think we want to electrify everything, we won't be able to. Heavier duty kind of applications and things like that. And then there's the question of, is it dead in terms of, policy, right? And so we can improve the internal combustion engine all we want. We can talk about how it needs to be part of the future solution, but government sort of has control here and they can say, as they are making some claims now, 2035, 2032, whatever the year is, it changed 4 or 5 times in the UK as we were writing the book, basically, right? Whatever year they want to ban it, they certainly can. I tend to believe that these are politicians saying, making future claims that someone else will have to deal with. And it's a really good political marketing message. Do I think it's really going to happen? I think they'll try in some countries, but I think they're going to realize it doesn't make any sense. So short answer, no, I don't think the internal combustion engine is dead.
So Kelly, I'm gonna let Felix answer, but let me come back to ask you the other question.
Sure.
By the way, I don't even think we can ever even talk about internal combustion engines as a category of one thing, because they can range from, I guess, 2 cc's to 100 liters. And depending on whether we are powering a cargo ship or a bicycle, they function very differently to a degree. So, but let's go to your point. You say there that you think it's possible politicians could begin to ban them. and then realize the error of their ways. Do you really think that there would be a point where there could be a ban and politicians realize the error of their ways? And then do you see them really backtracking to say, let's bring back engines?
That's a tough question to answer. You know, that is tough, because once you make political decisions, it is very tough to kind of backtrack. Although I'll say, you know, we've seen it in the US where depending on who's in power, things are swinging really far one way or the other. I tend to believe we should be meeting in the middle and kind of doing something a little more less extreme one way or the other. So I do think with changes in power, I think it could happen. I guess I'm holding on to, it won't get to that point in the first place.
Yeah.
That we won't really ban them. Cause I agree. Once we make that decision, it's hard for politicians to kind of reverse that, especially now the auto companies are now fully invested in the other technology. It's a little bit of a bait and switch if they say, you know, you have to go one way and then, oh, we were just kidding, you can come back this other way. It's a little bit weird. So I hope we just don't get to that point to begin with. I hope reality sets in, and I hope we start to do our regulate, and I'll talk more about this maybe later if there's a chance, but I hope our regulations start to truly reflect, you know, the real impact of these vehicles, and then governments start to see kind of the error in their ways of throwing out bans.
Felix and Kelly, we're going to go take a break, and then we'll come back and continue this great conversation.
Zero is a big number. Getting close to a zero emissions future starts with using the broadest mix of clean, low-carbon energy sources. You might be surprised to know that propane produces a lot of energy for thousands of purposes and millions of people with virtually zero particulate matter, zero impact to the ozone, zero toxicity, and zero potential for storage-related contamination. It's low NOx and low CO2 to boot. Path to Zero is sponsored by Propane. Energy for everyone. Learn more at propane.com.
Welcome back. We're talking with Dr. Felix Leach and Dr. Kelly Senecal about their new book called Racing Towards Zero, The Untold Story of Driving Green. Felix, is the internal combustion engine dead?
No. Simple answer. I think I'd perhaps come at it from a slightly different perspective than Kelly, not least because Europe is taking quite a different path to the US at the moment. In some respects, we're kind of further along the path towards bans. But as you said yourself, Tucker, internal combustion engines could be in anything from a chainsaw to a kind of oil tanker, ship. So we just need to think about what the application is. Will they be in everything that they are today in the future? No, of course they won't. I think what I hope is that we end up with a more diverse future with different kind of power sources. But the challenge here is not necessarily the internal combustion engine, it's the fuel we use to power it, right? And so are fossil fuels dead? Well, they possibly should be in some senses, but I think that we can get towards renewable fuels and, you know, whether that's hydrogen or something else, e-fuels that are sort of made from electricity and sort of renewable energy, then why would we need to kill the internal combustion engine? Because it too can be part of our sort of sustainable future. So I don't think it will be dead, although the number of applications will reduce, I think. And it certainly shouldn't be dead, because I think it's a really important part of how we decarbonize going forwards.
I know you address it some in your book, but one of the things that I never hear politicians talk about, or even anyone really engaging in the debate, truly talk about the cost of running alternatives to internal combustion engines. The presumption always is that because electricity could be cheaper, that the cost to operate a battery electric vehicle will be cheaper. Yet I've seen 5 studies, each of them across a variety of fuels, gasoline, natural gas, diesel, propane, electric. And in each of those 5 studies, the electric vehicle was towards the top of the cost per mile. In your work, do you think about, and I always think about cost in terms of from the fleet manager's perspective, cost per mile, cost per drop, however you want to think about it. Do you see that battery electric will have a strategic advantage in cost per mile over time over an IC engine?
I hate conversations about cost because I'm not an economist. But what I do see from a European perspective is that cost is a really tricky area to answer because there's so many subsidies, both hidden and less hidden, both for internal combustion engine and for battery electric vehicles. And in particular, in the last, say, 4 or 5 years in Europe, the number of government subsidies that have gone towards battery electric vehicles have really, really, really added up. And so I think the question then becomes, would those subsidies sustain into the future? It's difficult to see that they can. So, for example, in the UK, the taxation that we pay on what I would call petrol, gasoline, perhaps to you guys, is the third largest tax take in the whole of the UK, £28 billion a year. And we pay much higher taxes on our fuel than you do in the US. It seems illogical to me that the government will take away all of that revenue without having to tax something else. But at the moment, our electricity prices are going up, not down, in part because of, you know, war, but in part because of, you know, global kind of shifts towards different types of production, and indeed the cost of converting the electrical power grids to more renewable sources. So I struggle to see how this can be done while getting cheaper. I think we're going to need to invest billions and billions of pounds in decarbonizing. I struggle to see how that will make things cheaper.
I mean, I too am not an economist, but I will say with total certainty, the cost of electricity will rise across the continent and the world because of a variety of issues. But while the sun may be free and the wind may blow free, to harness that power, to put it in places where people want to use it, and power is not energy dense, right? I mean, you are coming from a world where we're talking about richly dense fuels. Diesel fuel particularly is, and so at least every study we've worked with, every group we've worked with, the cost of electricity is going to rise significantly.
Yeah, and Tucker, what I will also say is it's not just about where you generate it, it's also about when you generate it, and then importantly, storing it. You know, one of the nice things about gasoline and diesel is that they are energy stores, right? And you store enough energy to drive, 400 or 500 miles in a 50, 100 liter fuel tank on a vehicle. To do that with raw electricity in batteries and electrochemical storage, you need much, much larger volume and indeed weight. So I think energy storage on a grid scale will also be really important. So living in the UK, there are often days when the wind's not blowing and the sun's not shining in the winter. What do we do then?
Right. And energy storage on a grid scale is certainly not even in its infancy today, I'm quick to think, right? The way we store it in batteries, I know you have a couple of high profile battery storage projects in Europe. Certainly Australia has one going. They have a couple in the US, but the way we're going to store energy, I believe 30 years from now, we'll look back at energy storage and kind of laugh. We'll think about it like the Model T or the Wright brothers. Let's ask, as I sit here and listen to you and I read your book to prepare for this, you make such a logical engineer's viewpoint about the importance of internal combustion engines. And again, the importance, even in a society that is rightfully obsessed with climate. So that you've said it here today several times, the engine can improve, the fuel can improve, that system of propulsion should be at the seat at the table as we think about the future of transportation. Why do you think the narrative is so wrong then? In the common narrative, the narrative of the politician, the narrative of the environmental advocate often. How has that narrative become so wrong that the only path forward is this narrow path towards electrification?
Yeah, I can start on that one. That's really interesting that you say that because I find that the really hardcore environmentalists don't like electric vehicles. Right, the ones that they don't like any vehicles, to be honest. but I've seen some of them make the point that, you know, what are we doing replacing cars with just different cars? But I think a lot of it comes down, and I really like to talk about this because it's really one of my pet peeves. Felix knows it also bothers him, but this idea of a zero emission vehicle, right? So it's not only a problem that we call it that because words matter, right? If you call something a zero emission vehicle, people are just going to start to believe it's a zero emission vehicle, especially people who aren't so tied to the industry. But the real problem is we regulate them that way, right? So we regulate at the tailpipe, which made sense you know, in the 1970s, when we kind of started these regulations, when pretty much every vehicle on the road has a tailpipe, and that's where most of the emissions come from on an internal combustion engine vehicle. They come from other places as well, but most of it comes from the tailpipe. That made sense. But now that we've evolved our technology, and again, as we make a point in the book, battery electric vehicles aren't exactly new, but sort of the numbers of them are new and the technology has really improved. We haven't evolved the regulations, right? So now we've essentially moved the tailpipe away from the vehicle in a lot of cases, but yet we still regulated the tailpipe. And I think that is a major problem. Auto companies actually like that, because now they can, when they do their fleet averaging on their CO2 emissions, for example, they can take a big zero for that electric vehicle, sometimes even more than one zero, if that makes sense. anything multiplied by zero is still zero, but they can count it as, say, two cars or one and a half cars or whatever. That allows them to sell their big trucks, right? So that's really kind of where we are. And I was just at a conference last week, and one of the points I and others made at that conference was decarbonization does not equal electrification. Right? Electrification is certainly a tool to help us get there. But as you said, as a society, we've really sort of equated the two. And that's a big problem. And as soon as we start to look at the whole, what we call life cycle analysis about where all the emissions are formed, you start to realize that, wait a minute. Sometimes that's true. In places like Norway, certainly, electric vehicles can be very clean. But in other parts of the world, for example, in Wisconsin, where I am here, it makes much more sense for me to drive a hybrid based on our electricity grid. So I think it all, not all of it, but a lot of it comes down to this idea of a zero emission vehicle and focusing so much on the tailpipe. I think that's where we've kind of gotten into this mess.
Yeah, brilliant point. I mean, I know I go often and hear people talk about zero emission vehicles, and I'm quick to counter that. No, nothing's zero, right? Nothing's zero. They just move the tailpipe essentially from the car to the power plant. So, Kelly, you mentioned it, but Felix, I'm going to ask you to talk about it, because you write a lot about hybrid technology. And I think even in my experience in working with fleets or automakers, there has been a real reluctance to use hybrids in favor of either straight internal combustion or straight battery electric. Where do you see the sweet spot for hybrids, and why has there not been such a revolution towards hybrids?
So I think the hybrid is by far and away the best way that we can decarbonize as quickly as possible. We live in a world where battery electric vehicles have some, you know, efforts towards decarbonization, but there aren't enough of them, and they're not going to be enough of them rapidly. But more importantly, we exist in a supply chain constrained world as well. They're getting all the raw materials. And so you're creating vehicles with very, very large batteries, you know, in some cases, hundreds of kilowatt hours of batteries, which have a lot of embedded carbon, to drive, you know, 20 miles to and from work or to and from the shops or whatever. You'd be much better off splitting up that, say, 100 kilowatt hours of battery into 25 kilowatt hour batteries, putting them in hybrids. And the sort of the bang for your buck that you get in decarbonization terms is massive. Then, you know, you could suddenly reduce the emissions from 20 vehicles instead of one rapidly. Now, why they haven't caught on, I think it comes back to legislation. You know, if suddenly the only acceptable answer out of a tailpipe is zero, a hybrid's not going to be zero in that sense. But like you were just saying, if you've moved the emissions to the power plant, it still counts as zero. And so I think hybrids, you know, are struggling because of the legislative and sort of regulatory framework that they're placed in. That doesn't mean they're not a brilliant technology, and I'm a real passionate advocate for hybrids as a way of rapidly decarbonizing. I think, you know, forget banning internal combustion engines in the UK by 2030. I think you could say every vehicle has to be a hybrid by 2025. That's a much more achievable goal, and you'd get faster decarbonization.
Tucker, can I add a little bit to that? Do you mind?
Absolutely, Kelly.
So here's a great kind of real world example of hybrids. And let's talk about full hybrids. So not the kind that you plug in. What some people call self-charging. Felix hates that. I don't like it that much either, but maybe I hate it a little bit less. But that type of hybrid, so Toyota, we talked about Toyota earlier. Toyota they made a decision on their Toyota Sienna, a minivan, right? So the new version of the Toyota Sienna only comes out as a full hybrid. It's only available as a full hybrid, from my understanding. Okay, so they went from a vehicle that was, say, mid-20s MPG to something that's like mid-30s MPG by making it a full hybrid, okay? The consumer doesn't really know, right? It doesn't change any consumer habits at all, right? But yet we've, in sort of that decision that Toyota made, which I think was a great decision, and I really applaud sort of, you know, Toyota's sort of push, and they've been doing it since the 90s, right, on hybrid vehicles. That makes a huge impact. People are buying it like hotcakes, and they're getting much better fuel economy, and obviously that means less CO2.
Kelly and Felix, this conversation is too good to stop. So for timing purposes, let's wrap this up, and we'll call it part one of a two-part series. Listeners, we'll conclude this incredibly smart conversation in part two, which I know you're going to enjoy.
Thank you for listening to Path to Zero with Tucker Perkins. If you like what you've heard, subscribe and rate us your favorite podcast app. You can email us with questions or comments to pathtozero@propane.com.